percent chance of showers before about 1 a.m., mostly cloudy skies with a low around 53. It's currently 43 degrees. The relative humidity is 89%. The winds are calm, and the barometric pressure is 30.39. The time now is 8:10 here on WGTD.
Welcome you to the Monday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. And in this portion of WGTD's Morning Show, a tale of extraordinary heroism found in a young teenage Syrian boy. It's the story of Mohammed Najem, told in a wonderful new book called Mohammed Najem, War Reporter, How One Boy Put the Spotlight on Syria. This is a book actually co-created by Mohammed Najem and by journalist Nora Noos, who was with CNN at the time that she first connected with this incredibly courageous boy who was endangering himself trying to capture powerful images of what was going on at the time in war-torn Syria. And this story is told brilliantly well in this book, which is published by Little Brown and Company. And I'm so honored to be speaking with journalist Nora Noos about her encounter with Mohammed Najem and the experience of telling his story in this wonderful new book, intended for young readers, but a book that all of us need to take the time to read. Nora Noos, we welcome you to the Morning Show.
Thank you so much, Greg.
I really appreciated the opportunity to see this book, and it tells this important story so very, very well. Just ahead of us, telling us about how you first connected with young Mohammed and found out the work that he was doing, remind our listeners about when the time period that we are talking about and what was going on in Syria at the time.
So about 5 years ago, the conflict was still raging, and there were pockets of Syria that were essentially rebel-held territory, and that included a suburb around Damascus, which is where Mohammed and his family were living. At the time, he was 15 years old, and he started posting these videos of what he was experiencing in Syria, and part of that was a siege on his community that was essentially bombed day in and day out for weeks on end. And that's when I first saw some of his videos.
One of the stories that we see in this book is how young Mohammed was inspired by somewhat similar work that somebody else in his life was doing. Explain who this was and the way in which he was an inspiration to Mohammed.
So Mohammed's older brother was a reporter during the war, and he would go out and interview people about their experiences. And a lot of these people were adults. And Mohammed was watching this as a kid and thinking, you know, me and my friends are also going through this war. The kids are also going through this war, and we have a different perspective to show. And even at that young age, Mohammed was also a little bit cagey enough to recognize that the international community tends to have more sympathy for children. And Mohammed got it in his head that if he could do what his older brother does, that if he could go out and interview other kids about what it was like to live in the war, and the international community could see it, then, well, maybe something good would happen.
One thing that's interesting, the way this some of these first conversations are depicted in the book, is of Mohammed's older brother kind of saying, well, I have little kids, and a lot of my photographs, he was mostly a photojournalist, but yes, he did interview people as well. And yeah, there are little kids in these pictures. And of course, Muhammad's point was it needs to be more than just seeing their faces. We need to hear from them and hear their stories of what it is like to live through this. And I just thought that was really insightful for somebody so young to realize that that was an untold story that needed to be told.
And that's something that their father really instilled in them from a young age. Their father would always say to them, you know, everyone has a story. And as kids, they would get kind of annoyed. Their dad was always around talking to people when they wanted to go places. But that was really instilled in them that everyone, including children, have their own story to tell.
So explain exactly what young Muhammad did when he began doing this work of capturing the stories of children, stories and images as well. Where would he go? How would he go about doing this?
He would take his cheap cell phone out into the streets, and it started off with his cousins. He's a lot of cousins and his friends, and he would just ask them questions about what it was like to live during the war. And as he got kind of more comfortable with it, he started posting these videos on YouTube and on Twitter. And they only got having a couple views here and there. But he kept doing it, kept at it. And he interviewed kids who were playing soccer, which he was really into during the war. He would interview other young kids just about what it was like to live during these bombings. And as he would post them, there would get slightly more and slightly more views. And when I saw one of his first videos, it had, I think, about 200 views. By no means viral at that point.
And of course, your intervention really changed that. And we'll talk about that in just a moment. Mm-hmm. I think another interesting part of all this that I don't think would have otherwise dawned on me, I'm so glad it's part of the way this story is told, is of some of the guidance and probably life-saving advice that Muhammad's older brother gives him as he begins posting things, and in some cases is about to post things rather carelessly or recklessly that could potentially put their family in even more grave danger. Explain this kind of guidance that Muhammad was given.
The Assad regime in Syria has a relatively sophisticated digital monitoring ability or program, depending on how you want to put it. And so they really are looking at not just publicly posted videos, but also private communications. But in this case, Muhammad was starting to develop a target on his back just by what he was posting. And his older brother was very firm with him that he needed to be careful never to post videos that showed their home, that showed the outside of their home, that showed their exact street, nothing that could be triangulated back to exactly where to find him. And how to kill him.
We're speaking with journalist Nora Noose, who is co-author of a book called Muhammad Najim, War Reporter, How One Boy Put the Spotlight on Syria. So was it completely by accident that you first stumbled on the videos of Muhammad Najim? And what did you think when you first saw them?
Essentially, yes. I was studying for my Master of War Studies, and so I was looking at the ways that social media was impacting international conflict and the way that media covered international conflict. And I really did just stumble across these videos, and it took some time to verify that they were, in fact, real, that Muhammad really was in this community in Syria, that he was doing this of free will even. And so we were able to, with the resources of CNN, verify his story. And that very first video that I saw was one of the ones, it's actually the scene depicted on the cover of the book now, but it's when he was standing on the roof of a building with bombs dropping in the background. And the thing that kind of caught me was he was explaining what was happening, and his voice kind of broke a little and betrayed that he was scared. And of course he would be. I would have been terrified in that situation. But he is 15, standing on this roof of this building, and he's scared, and yet he's doing it anyway. And that was really the thing that pulled me in.
So explain to our listeners what you and CNN did from this point on in terms of Muhammad.
So I pitched a story for CNN.com. I was producing for Anderson Cooper at this point on the TV side of things, but I pitched a story. It was just honestly kind of a side project. It was just an article and a little video. And what we didn't expect is that it would go completely viral almost overnight. And all of a sudden, Muhammad's videos had tens of thousands of views and even more. And he, around the same time, from my perspective, he went completely silent. The article posted, he said he loved it, and then I didn't hear from him for days afterwards.
Explain that silence.
Well, it turned out that the siege had intensified, and in the following days, there was a concerted attempt to label Muhammad a crisis actor, to say that he was acting, that one of the comments said that he was a prep school kid from America, and this is all just a sham. And a lot of them were from Russian state TV. And a few days later, there was a Russian-backed airstrike in Muhammad's neighborhood. And he had still, and we of CNN still had been careful not to show his exact address, but there was an attack directly on his neighborhood. And we'll never know for sure if it was a targeted hit, but the circumstances and the timing is extremely suspicious, and their family certainly believes that it was. And so Muhammad and his family were buried alive in that strike, and they survived. They survived, but then not everyone in their family ended up making it out alive from the end of that strike.
It's important for people to understand, if they explore this book, that there is plenty of heartbreak in this story, Muhammad loses some people who are very, very dear to him. He thankfully does survive. And we should say also that this book, which is sequential art, I mean, kind of like a comic book, so the story told in both words and illustrations, also includes some photographs in which we see Muhammad himself and some of his family members and even some of the scenes and locales depicted in this story. I wonder if you could just say a word about one thing that is Muhammad's choice, which is a brilliant choice that maybe would not have occurred to somebody else attempting to do the same thing. And that is for him to do these videos not in Arabic, but rather in English. Explain why he made that choice, a choice that his older brother, for one, did not fully understand, but it proved to be a brilliant choice.
It did, and the only reason that this could have happened was because of Muhammad's older sister, Hiba, who spoke English and was teaching as one of her many, many jobs during the war. And Muhammad had this realization. You mentioned earlier that he was very insightful for a young kid, and that's certainly true. He was kind of prescient in a lot of the ways he thought about these things, but he decided that he wanted the international community, and especially Americans, to understand what was really happening there in hopes that there would be more international intervention. And so he would write out his scripts in Arabic, and his sister would translate them and would help him learn those English phrases. And you go back and watch some of those original videos, and the English is a little bit rough. And he laughs at that now, because now his English is incredible. He's close to fluent now in the last 3-5 years. But he decided to make these videos in English, and I think that really is the thing that made him stand out.
Well, it's a great choice that he made, and it's, of course, one reason why this story gripped so many people both here and around the world. He is alive and well in Turkey. And what are his aspirations for the rest of his life?
He wants to continue making an enormous difference, not only for Syrians, but for children of war everywhere. He is continuing to learn English and to learn Turkish. He wants to finish his education, which he was never able to finish. And he is genuinely one of the most spectacular people I've ever met.
It's incredible. And one of the lines in the book haunts me. At one point, we hear Muhammad, in a sense, saying to us, "Sometimes it felt like we," meaning Syria, "were a chew toy that a bunch of dogs were fighting over." Such a brilliant way to describe such a tragic situation. And the story of Muhammad's courage told so well in this book, Muhammad Najim, War Reporter, How One Boy Put the Spotlight on Syria, published by Little Brown and Company, co-authored by journalist Nora Noose. Nora Noose, thank you so much for helping bring Muhammad's reporting to the world and for your hand in creating this important book. And thank you for being my morning show guest today.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it. Thank you.
You're listening to The Morning Show on WGTD FM 91.1, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg, and now an interview from The Morning Show archives. We are going to be talking today on The Morning Show about resilience. It's a term which gets bandied about, but which most of us don't begin to really fully appreciate. And of course, what we're really talking about is not the resilience of stainless steel. We're talking about the resilience of the human heart, about the human soul, and about the capacity for human beings to be resilient even in the face of grave difficulties of one kind or another. The book at hand by Eric Gretens is called Resilience, Hard-Won Wisdom for Living a Better Life. And the author is someone who has tasted adversity and challenges of various kinds through his life. His experience as a U.S. Navy SEAL through several different deployments, a recipient of the Purple Heart and Bronze Star. He is also quite the scholar, with a Ph.D. from Oxford University as a Rhodes Scholar, teaches as a senior fellow at the Truman School of Public Affairs at the University of Missouri and at the Olin School of Business at Washington University. He has several best-selling books to his credit, including The Heart and the Fist, The Education of a Humanitarian, The Making of a Navy SEAL, and The Warrior's Heart, Becoming a Man of Compassion and Courage. One of the things he is best known for is for founding a great organization for veterans called The Mission Continues, which empowers veterans to make a positive difference in their own communities. And, of course, he has done tireless work on behalf of veterans to help them contend with the ravages of what they have experienced, and in order to have the richest and most meaningful lives that they possibly can. And towards that end, this book has been written called Resilience. Eric Gretens, we welcome you back to The Morning Show.
Greg, so good to be on with you. Thanks very much for having me today.
This book, Resilience, is set up in a sense as a series of letters which you wrote to a former Navy SEAL comrade whom you call Zach Walker, although I'm pretty sure you actually change his name to ultimately protect his identity. Tell us more about him, because I think it's important to know the kind of stern stuff from which he was made, which helps put into proper perspective then the terrible difficulties which he faced once he was home from his deployment.
Yeah, Greg, so Zach was a tough kid from a Northern California logging family, and he went with me through BUDS, the Basic Underwater Demolition SEAL Team Training. And even in a SEAL Team Training class, this guy was one of the toughest of the tough. After our training, he went off to Afghanistan, did a deployment, came home, sort of welcomed home as a war hero, bought a concrete pumper, started a concrete business, good father to his two young kids. And then what happened, Greg, is that his life was just hammered by hardship. His brother died. He lost his business. He drove his truck into his driveway one day, got out, dropped to the ground because he thought there was a sniper who was watching him. He laid there for hours, and then he got up and ran into his house, and he realized that he had post-traumatic stress disorder. And then what happened was that he started drinking, and Zach did nothing in moderation. So on the weekend, it wasn't a six-pack of beer, but a cooler full of beer that he'd be working through. And then he called me, actually, after he'd been arrested. So now my friend, who was once the Navy SEAL, war hero, small businessman, entrepreneur coming home, is now the unemployed alcoholic on disability who's looking at the prospect of having his kids come to visit him in jail. We talked that night as I was driving home, and then when I got home, I started writing him a letter about resilience, a letter about how you build this virtue that helps you to get better when things are hard. He wrote back to me, and the book is a series of 23 letters. It draws from my experience. It draws from a lot of ancient wisdom about how we can deal with pain and build wisdom, how you deal with fear and build courage, how you can move through suffering and actually become stronger on the other side.
If we looked at the actual letters that you wrote to Zach Walker, reaching out to him, trying to offer whatever help you could, I wonder what those letters would look like. I guess in some ways what I'm asking is ultimately how different were the actual letters you wrote to him versus what we see in this book, which of course for all kinds of understandable reasons are reshaped and edited and so on in a sense that's more appropriate for this kind of a book. But I'm just curious, what were those original letters like? How many roughly were there? And whatever you feel like sharing about them, I think would be really interesting.
Yeah, of course, Greg. You know, I mean, these letters actually are very close to the real letters that I wrote to Zach. Now, you know, a couple of differences, of course. You know, at the beginning of the letter, I'd give him an update on how I was doing, how Sheena was doing. I had a son just 8 months ago, and, you know, while we were writing these letters, I was giving him updates on expecting Joshua's arrival and then, you know, when Joshua came. And we'd talk a little bit about his kids. I'd ask him how his wife was doing. So a lot of that kind of, you know, personal back and forth, a little reminder of a SEAL buddy who I just talked to or somebody who he had talked to. You know, that stuff we shaped out of the letters. But really, these letters are pretty close to what I was writing to my friend because, you know, he really, this was a guy who was incredibly smart. Now, you know, had a high school education, and he would tell you himself didn't necessarily do great in high school, but like so many people in our culture, so wise, so thoughtful, and he really wanted to dig into some of these ideas about how you build resilience, and it helped him to create a lot of clarity in his own thinking. So these letters are pretty close to the letters that I wrote to my buddy.
I think one thing that's really interesting is that your book helps us sort of understand the whole notion of, well, for obviously resilience, but even before that, just kind of the notion of what philosophy is. Because, of course, the fact is plenty of people who read your book, in fact, most of the people who read your book are not going to be PhDs from Oxford who can put Rhodes Scholar in their biography. I mean, I'm sure you hope that, in fact, a lot of so-called ordinary people in the sense of academic credentials will take this book in hand and make sense of it, even though, you know, at a glance, a lot of what you write about are matters of philosophy, which I think a lot of people think has nothing to do with them and nothing to do with their humdrum ordinary lives, if that's the way they look at their own life. And one of the things you say is that we all have a philosophy by which we live. and it's important to understand that. And it's also important to understand what the philosophy is by which you live your own life. And a lot of people never stop to even think about that.
Yeah, I mean, if you think back on what philosophy used to be, I mean, today when people think about philosophy, they think of people sitting and talking, right? Or maybe they think of people reading and thinking. But philosophy used to be a discipline of thinking and living. And the measure of whether or not something was a quality philosophy was whether or not it helped people to actually live a good life. And so, you know, philosophy is about hard work. It's about taking an honest and searching look at our lives. And that's always been difficult. People have always, in some ways, you know, resisted it, but good philosophy involves deliberately making yourself uncomfortable. It involves asking yourself a tough question about responsibility, for example. You know, are there excuses that I'm making in my life that are making me less resilient than I should be? How can I take control? How can I take responsibility for what's happening and what I'm doing so that I actually build resilience in my life? And you learn that ideas matter, and the way that we think about key virtues matters, even resilience itself. You know, a lot of times in our culture, when people think about resilience, they think about bouncing back. I mean, if you ask somebody, what does it mean to be resilient? They'll say, well, it means that you can bounce back, you can bounce back. But it turns out that that idea of resilience actually comes to us from physics. So in physics, there's this principle of elastic resilience. It's the measure of the ability of an object to return to its prior state after it's been hit by an outside force, especially compressive stress. And that's how people think about resilience in human life. But the fact is, human beings can't bounce back. And the reason why you can't bounce back is because you can't go back in time. So the 19-year-old kid who leaves for Afghanistan is never going to be 19 again. And parents who lose a child are never going to be the same parents again. An entrepreneur who loses a business is never going to be the same entrepreneur again. We all are affected by hardship and difficulty. And what resilient people are able to do is not to bounce back from hardship. They're able to integrate hard experiences into their lives in such a way that they become better. So we take some concepts like that. We talk about what it means to build virtues in your lives. And we put them together in a very practical way so that they could actually help my friend. And I hope will help anybody who reads this book to build resilience.
I especially appreciated that point you made about how we need to stop thinking about resilience as bouncing back, as returning to our original state. And I suppose one of the reasons it's good to think about that is because if one has that unreasonable expectation that that's the ultimate goal, to bounce back, to become the person you used to be, then they are subject to great disappointment and disillusionment. But if you understand that that really cannot be the goal, that should not be the goal, that in and itself is probably a very significant plus in whether or not someone is ultimately going to become resilient, if they understand what it means to be resilient.
That's exactly right, Greg, because a lot of times we actually hurt people when we tell them that they're supposed to bounce back. You know, think about somebody who has lived through a tragedy. Think about somebody who's lost a loved one, or even think about someone who's lost their job or who's lost a business. Like, when hard things happen to you, they are going to affect you and they are going to change you. And again, this is another idea that we kind of take from physics. And what we talk about in resilience is when hardship hits you, it doesn't hit you when you're at rest. We're always moving. We're always moving through time. So hardship is going to change your trajectory. And we have choices that we can make in our lives about what direction we actually move in and how we're changed by hardship. And what resilient people learn to do is that they learn how to take responsibility. They learn how to develop purpose in the face of pain. They learn how to tell stories about themselves. They learn how to create a sense of identity. They learn how to use mental toughness techniques to confront fear. All of these things we can draw from in order to actually get better in the face of hardship. And we do sometimes a real disservice to people and even harm when we tell them that they're supposed to find closure. I mean, think about what it's like to lose a child. Think about how hard that is. Like, you're never going to have closure with that. That's always going to be with you. And the question is, how does this affect you as you move forward? And how can you move through what's going to be genuinely hard in your life and create some sense of wisdom, some sense of purpose, some sense of strength?
One of the things I appreciate about your book, and I think it helps us understand why it's all right to talk about, for instance, the philosophy of ancient Greeks whose names we've barely seen, can barely pronounce, and know nothing about, is the fact that, in your words, their collective wisdom belongs to all of us, and that we have every right to access that collective wisdom and make it part of our own lives. And I think that might seem like a really obvious point to some people, but I think it's such an important thing to say, because otherwise, I think particularly, again, for the person who's not a Rhodes Scholar and with a PhD, they probably feel like they have no business treading on this sort of sacred, hallowed ground of ancient philosophers, and we all belong there.
Absolutely, Greg. I mean, this is the thing. This is all of our inheritance. And there is this tremendous wisdom that's been built up. Edith Hamilton called all of this wisdom, she called it the fortresses of the spirit, which people have built throughout the ages. And I love that phrase, the fortresses of the spirit, that there's real wisdom there. And I think too often today, we think that this is something just to be studied in universities or in classrooms. But in fact, the people who wrote this stuff, they wrote it because they lived real and hard lives. So Aeschylus, who is a Greek poet who is often considered to be the father of tragedy, Aeschylus was a veteran. And he lived a hard life as a soldier. And when he writes about living that life, he writes things like, "Our beds right up against the enemy walls, rain from the sky, dew from the ground soaking us perpetually, rotting our clothes, filling our hair with vermin." He says, "I could tell you stories of winter so cold it killed the birds in the air." I mean, this is a person who really lived a hard life and then came back and took a combination of wisdom from that life, thinking about how you make it through hardship. And then he wrote things where he said, you know, all of us experience pain, but he writes, "And in our own despite, or against our will, comes wisdom to us by the awful grace of God." And the thought was that there actually can be wisdom in that pain. And when you go back and you read Aeschylus, you read Sophocles, you read Seneca, you read Marcus Aurelius, you see these were folks who were struggling with the same kinds of things that all of us struggle with today. And too often we don't go back and see that they've really left a gift for all of us if we're willing to go back and tap into it and see how we apply it to our own lives.
For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Eric Rettens about his new book, which is called Resilience, in which he explores the notion of what it means to be resilient and how someone can take on resilience in their own lives, especially as they are contending with difficulties of one kind or another. You just touched on a really important matter. That is the fact that you wrote this book, you yourself, as a veteran. What the catalyst for this project was reaching out to a fellow veteran who reached out to you in despair. But that this book is not intended to be read only by people who have experienced terrible hardships because of service in the military. This is really meant for anybody and everybody who is going to contend with all kinds of different things. And I appreciate the fact that you, at repeated points in the book, address that sort of matter, that all of us face all kinds of difficulties. And in fact, at one point you write about how all of us experience life on the front line, even though that's a specifically military term. You use it to describe that point in everyone's life where you are confronting something incredibly difficult. Talk more about that.
You know, one of the things that I explain to my friend Zach is I say, you know, as a Navy SEAL, you understand the word front line to mean the place where you meet the enemy. And people recognize that the front line in a military sense, it's a place where battles are fought, where fates are decided. It's a place of fear and struggle and suffering and chaos and change and difficulty. But people also recognize that it's on the front line where victory is won. And it's often on a front line where friendships of a lifetime are forged. And what I say is, like, front line isn't just a military term. Everybody has a front line in their life. Everyone, I, my friend Zach, you, Greg, we all have a place where we encounter fear, where we struggle, where we suffer, where we face hardship. We all have battles to fight. And the fact is, it's often in those battles where we're most alive. It's often in the front lines of our lives where we earn wisdom, where we create joy, where we forge friendships, where we discover happiness. And the fact is, if you want to win any meaningful kind of victory, you'll have to fight for it. And it's often on those front lines where we actually have the greatest opportunities for growth.
Hmm. One of the things you say that is a significant point to make, maybe so simple that some wouldn't bother to say it, and yet it's so important, that resilience begins with a choice. What is the choice that people sometimes fail to make that leads them to resiliency?
Well, one of the things that you have to recognize is that we always say resilience begins with you. And when I say this to my friend Zach, I'm saying resilience begins with you. You have a choice to make. These things have happened in your life. There's nothing that you can do to change them, but you have a choice to make about how you're going to live your life moving forward. Are you going to allow this tragedy to break you, or are you going to find something in it to make you stronger? And it begins, one of the core choices that we have to make is that we have to take responsibility for what we can take responsibility for. A lot of times in our lives, it seems like everything can be out of control. But one of the things that you learned, and I reminded Zach of this, is that when you learn how to survive if you're ever taken prisoner of war, you realize that you can be in a situation where your freedom is gone, your very ability to stand up has been taken from you, your ability to eat has been taken from you, but what resilient prisoners are able to do is that they're able to say to themselves, I'm responsible for my mind, I'm responsible for my thoughts, or I'm responsible for the way that I breathe. And so what you do, what resilient people do, is they figure out what they can take responsibility for, what they can be in control of. And then as you start taking control of one thing and then something else, you start to build a sense of responsibility and you actually find a way to become more resilient. So you find that that choice about being responsible is at the core of resilience. And then there are a number of different choices that you can make from that. You can figure out, how do I build purpose in the face of this pain? How do I find a model to make it through hardship and through difficulty? How do I apply mental toughness techniques to address the fear that I'm feeling? All of those things can be done, but you have to make a choice to say, like, I'm going to be responsible here, and I'm going to find a way to build resilience.
Right. I love that philosophy. I appreciate at one point when you say you are responsible for how you deal with what happens to you, which is different from saying you're responsible for what happens to you. I mean, we're seldom responsible for all the things that happen to us. I mean, we sometimes are, I suppose. But what you're really responsible for is how you're going to deal with what happens to you. And that's, of course, a responsibility that a whole lot of us like to shirk. I want to ask you more specifically about something you say right after that, when you say, if we take responsibility for ourselves, we become not victims, but pioneers. That's such an interesting choice of words. In what way does responsibility have anything at all to do with being a pioneer? What are you saying there?
So what's really interesting is that, and the ancients recognize this, is that we have a tremendous capacity to shape our own character. And what they recognized was that if you want to be courageous, then it's actually quite simple. You act with courage. And you do this once, and then twice, and then three times, four times, five times. And through the practice of acting with courage, you build courage. Through the practice of acting with compassion, you build compassion. And so the idea is that you are always in a place in your life where you have a choice to make about who you're going to become. And you're a pioneer in the sense that this is brand new, uncharted territory that you're walking into every day, and you have an opportunity to shape that future by the choices that you make and by the character that you build. And it's actually really hopeful for people because we recognize that this is hard, right? It's hard to do. It's hard to build new habits. It's hard to shape your character. But it's absolutely possible for all of us to do. And if we take responsibility and we think of it this way, we actually have a tremendous ability to shape who we ultimately become.
One moment that made me chuckle is when you write, if we make resilient choices, we become resilient. It sounds simple. It's like, if I put on shoes, I'm wearing shoes. You're actually not saying something quite as simplistic as that.
Yeah, and one of the things that we're saying there is that if you make resilient choices, you're actually going to build resilience in your life, and that they're kind
just
of
in the very act of making those choices.
Yes, in the very act of acting with compassion, you're actually shaping your character. And we talk about a lot of the different techniques that you can use to shape your character. And some of the key points that you have to recognize is that I emphasized for Zach is, number one, is that you can build resilience. Right? But that means that you can do it. No one else can build your resilience for you. You can have friends around you who help you, but you have to make these choices. The second point is that you can build resilience, that it's possible to build these virtues in your life. And the third point is that you can build resilience. This is not something that you can buy. It's not something that you can pay for. This is something that has to be built through the choices that you make. And so it sounds quite simple. You can build resilience, but there's actually three key points there. And once you sort of really digest all of them and you think about how this applies to the choices in my life, you start to see how you can make choices that will actually shape your future.
I think some of us looking on the outside in, who have never had the privilege of serving in the military, have some misunderstandings about what it means to serve in the military. And I think one of the misunderstandings, although perhaps there is some grain of truth in it, is that I think we sometimes think of the typical soldier as someone who is trained to, in a sense, follow orders. And to in a sense, to enter situations in which it's not about one's own sense of what should I do here. It's about following the orders that you have been given. And is there any danger that, to whatever extent that might be true, that in a way can erode one's own sense of personal responsibility and owning the own choices you make, if many of the choices that that you once upon a time were able to make about your own life are not your choices anymore, given the discipline of life in the military? Or is it that once you are plucked out of that situation and placed into the sort of the wide free world, suddenly choice means something different?
Yeah, it's a great question, Greg. And one of the things that I talk about in the book is how a lot of times in the culture, people want to approximate this language of soldiers and warfare, and they want to imagine that people in their businesses are generals or their troops that they're going to war. And one of the things that I say is that you have to remember what distinguishes a warrior. Right? That what distinguishes, what makes a warrior, is that they're serving a purpose that is larger than themselves. And that when somebody joins the United States military, for example, they take an oath to support and defend the Constitution of the United States. And what makes them a warrior is that they're willing to actually sacrifice some of their own personal desires in order to serve something that is larger than themselves. And I think in that sense, you know, that's really the lesson that we can take from all of us, is that actually serving something that is larger than yourself actually helps you to grow in strength. And the way I applied this to my buddy Zach's life when he came home was that he felt like he was lost. You know, there was no team around him. There was no sense of purpose every day. And I said to him, I said, Zach, you got to get out there, man. You just got to start serving again. You got to start showing other people that you have something to offer. And as you start serving others, you'll start to grow stronger. And what's really cool is I was just talking to Zach last night, and he's coaching football last fall. He's coaching baseball this spring. His team's doing great. He's getting them ready for their home opener, which is on April 4th. And he said, when I'm out coaching and I'm serving these kids, I'm getting stronger myself. And I think that's really the key lesson that we want to take from this, is that you actually become stronger when you're serving a purpose that is larger than yourself.
Hmm. And you write at one point, deprivation of purpose is as yes. destructive as deprivation of sleep. And of course, we yes. can really understand how someone can really fall into a very dark abyss when what was their consuming, all-consuming purpose at one point isn't there anymore. And they perhaps have not replace that with anything that even closely approximates it in terms of intensity.
Yeah, and this happens, Greg, not just to soldiers when they come home from war, but it happens to parents when their kids leave for college. It happens to people when they lose their job. It happens to athletes when they leave the game. It happens to people when they retire and they wonder, you know, what am I here for now? How am I going to make a difference? And for all of us in these situations, especially when we go through these kinds of transitions, it takes a lot of resilience, and we have to figure out ways to build a sense of purpose in this new environment moving forward.
Mm. You quote one of your favorite writers, Hemingway, at one point,
yes.
saying, "The world breaks everyone, and afterward, many are strong at the broken places." As you quote that, you point out the fact that it doesn't say everybody. None of this is automatic. Just because one suffers hardship does not mean one develops resilience, develops strength at those broken places.
That's exactly right. A lot of people remember Hemingway's phrase, strong at the broken places, and that's true, but we have to remember his qualifier, many. Not everyone is strong at the broken places. I mean, we all know people in our lives who've really been crushed by tragedy. We also know people who've actually become stronger in the face of it. We know people who've been broken by pain, and we know people who've become wiser in the face of it. So many people are stronger at the broken places, and the difference is in resilience. The difference is in how we actually build this virtue that helps us to move through hardship. And it's important for us to recognize that pain doesn't have any value in and of itself, right? We have to actually find ways to move through pain to recover from it. And sometimes with Zach, I even use physical analogies. You know, the analogy I always make is when you work out, when you exercise really intensely, you're actually weaker at the end of the workout than you were at the beginning. The way that you get stronger is by how your body recovers. When you go through rest and recovery, your body actually rebuilds itself and it becomes stronger because of the stress that's been applied to it. In the same way, in all of our lives, when we move through this pain and we move through this difficulty, we can either remain weakened by it or we can find ways to be resilient, to recover so that we actually become stronger.
I also appreciate the fact that you talk about resilience as something that is demonstrated over the course of time. In contrast to other similar virtues, which one can demonstrate in a moment, in an instant, one can demonstrate, I think, compassion is one of them that you talk about, or courage. But resilience, by its very nature, is something that is only demonstrated over the course of time.
Yeah, and that's one of the things that makes resilience so interesting as a virtue. You know, just like you said, courage, compassion, you can see an instance of it and you can say, whoop, that was an act of courage or there was an act of compassion. But to see resilience, it actually takes time. And it's why we learn about resilience best when we look at the arc of whole lives. And you ask people sometimes about things that were hard in their life and they'll tell you stories and they'll say, you know, I never wished that this would have happened to me, but in retrospect, it was one of the best things that ever happened. And you can't recognize that in the moment, but when people have this virtue of resilience, you can see over time how that effect actually takes place. And in the book, you know, I talk a lot about the nature of virtue. You know, the Greeks, the word that when we read a Greek text and we see the word virtue, the word that's usually being translated is arete. And arete in their world really meant something closer to excellence. And just like you could have an excellent painting or you could have an excellent, somebody could be an excellent runner, you could have an excellence of character. And the idea was that you could build an excellence of character over time, including the excellence, the virtue of resilience.
I know we are out of time, but I wonder if you could just take a moment to talk about this organization called The Mission Continues, which I know has been very near and dear to your heart. I ask it because I suspect that that particular project has something to do with helping veterans to rebuild this sense of resilience in their own lives.
Yeah, Greg, so when I came back from Iraq, my team had been hit by a suicide truck bomb. I was very fortunate. I was taken to the hospital. I was treated there. I was able to return to duty 72 hours later. But a lot of my friends were hurt far worse than I was. And when I came home, I went to Bethesda to the Naval Hospital to visit with some recently returned wounded Marines. And I recognize that all of them wanted to find a way to continue to serve. So I donated my combat pay from Iraq. Two friends put in some money from their disability checks, and we used that to start an organization called The Mission Continues. We're now operating across the country, and we help veterans as they come home to report for duty back in their communities, to continue that mission of service with Habitat for Humanities and Boys and Girls Clubs and Big Brothers, Big Sisters. And as they get back into their community and they rebuild a sense of team and a sense of purpose, it helps them to become stronger. So a lot of the insights in the resilience book have actually come from these last 7 years of work, working with my fellow veterans as they've come home.
And you have crafted a book that, of course, is going to be of tremendously important value. At one point, you quote 18th century Frenchman, the Marquis de Vauvenargues, saying, "A truly new and original book would be one which made people love old truths." And I think we can emphatically say that that is what this book is all about old truths, tried and true truths that surely can make a very positive difference in the lives of all kinds of people. The book, again, is Resilience, Hard-Fought Wisdom for Living a Better Life, published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt, and the author, Eric Greitens. I appreciate so much you writing this book and joining me today on The Morning Show to talk about it. Very best wishes to you.
Thank you, Greg. Great to be on with you.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, Dr. Herschel Kruger from the theater department at Carthage College talks about their current production.